It's Friday, September 12th, 2014, and you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Good morning and welcome to We the People Constitution Matters. I'm Bruce Stocking along with my co-host Corinne Lillis. And today's program is going to be a part two of what we started in discussing of last week, if you were with us, which is conventions of the states. So we will be joined with our contributors in just a few minutes, but I want to start with a little bit of a commentary about recent events and the Constitution itself for everybody. Of course, as we know that just the other day, President Barack Obama appeared for the American people to lay out a case for airstrikes in Syria. And since we're already doing such in Iraq, he wanted to present it to the people himself, but he's not going through Congress, which has raised a lot of issues that are on there, which is a continuation of what some have said. This president constantly sidesteps and violates the Constitution of the United States. Now, by doing such, what he is attempting to do, instead of going through Congress to declare any sense of war on this, he is now, through his Secretary of State, trying to change the verbiage of everything and saying that this is an anti-terrorist tactic that they're doing. It's quite simply the fact that this ISIL, has declared war on the United States, and which the declaration of war, in fact, he'd probably get from the Congress approval to go in and escalate. But he's trying to use a War Powers Act, which only allows the president to take quick military action for emergency situations. However, for any long duration, he is required to get the approval of Congress, and which he's trying to sidestep. For example, how a War Powers Act will work, I recall everyone back to the time of Libya and Ronald Reagan, where Ronald Reagan, after the Lockerbie, Scotland bombing of the aircraft, launched an attack on Libya, an airstrike on Libya. And as the strike was going, an hour into it, he appears on television to notify the American people that he has started airstrikes in Libya. They were only for that time period of that evening, and he was finished with it. Anything in longer duration would have required going to Congress. Well, this president has decided to sidestep that. It's not the first time. It will not be the last time, apparently, that this president will do such. We look at his overextended use of executive orders to achieve agendas that should go through Congress, to trying to go around Congress once again. We also look at the actions that he's done with the, what I call, Unaffordable Care Act, Obamacare, creating mandates where people of the United States, by law, are required to buy something and purchase something. Also, taxation used in that same law for punitive measures. Again, pure violations, and not to mention violations of equal justice for all with a DOJ, a Department of Labor, which is not equal justice for all. So these are continuing violations that have been taking place. He's not the first president to violate the Constitution, but in my mind, he's the first to violate it in a sustained long period, and there's two more years left of his presidency. James Madison once stated that liberty may be endangered by the abuse of liberty, but also by the abuse of power. So today's topic will be what we continued last week, which was the Convention of States. Joining us in studio is Sam Rohr, former state legislator, now president of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor, the law firm of Proctor and Lindsay, and on the phone, calling all the way from Hawaii, is Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitutional Leadership Initiative. Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am. And thanks to the Hawaiian music, because it really sets the stage. I was tempted to do this broadcast from out on the beach, listening to the, so you can hear the waves rushing in, but I decided to sit on a more quieter venue.
Yeah, so we decided to give you Don Ho and Tiny Bubbles. Now, I take it since you were contemplating calling in from the beach, you're strictly there for business.
Oh, strictly. Yes.
Oh, understood. Understood. You know, Chuck wanted me to ask you that actually, but so I did. But welcome to the program, Gary. Hope we can keep you awake. What time is it? 1 o'clock out there?
It is exactly 1:12.
Yes. Yeah. So a little bit of nose does get things going. Well, last week we talked about the Convention of States, and as we concluded at the end of the program. Well, we're going to do part two today, and so I'm going to let you lead it off with part two of the Convention of States and the piece that you wrote in a continuation for it, and also you got a little bit of a, well, feedback rebuttal article that went with it. Explain a little.
Right. Well, the whole thing that prompted this was a debate held on the 28th of August in Manassas, Virginia, between Virginia Delegate Bob Marshall and Michael Ferris. Now, Bob Marshall is a 12-year delegate in the Virginia Assembly, a very prominent and respected delegate on the Republican side. Michael Ferris, a respected constitutionalist, chancellor of Patrick Henry College, head of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, in fact, founder of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and he heads up the Convention of the States Project. So they were on opposite sides of these issues, both very long-standing friends, and I think they ended the debate still on friendly terms. But that's what prompted my essay of last week, was to report on this debate from my perspective, and then the newspaper published an article from a friend of mine, Carrie Nunley, in our local area, and she interviewed three people who also attended the debate and represented the opposing side. And so the newspaper readers got both sides of the issue in the paper last week. But as I reported, I didn't really want to call who won the debate, because I don't think you can go into one of these debates as an observer with a preconceived idea on how you view this issue and objectively score the debate, so I decided not to.
Yeah, you know, Gary, I kind of go with you on that. I happened to notice reading her article on it, in which it was looked at, you know, who won or lost. And this is one thing that's always concerned me with debates, is they always want to treat it like a sporting event, like who won, who lost, how many points did they get? And the fact is, if it's a debate, an exchange of ideas, an open exchange of ideas, everybody wins.
Right. Well, there have been debates where an attempt has been made to gauge whether anyone's opinion in the audience was swayed by what they heard, but there was no attempt to do that this time. But I'll tell you, as far as winners and losers go, who's going to lose here is the American people if we don't come up with some mechanism for restraining an over-aggressive federal government that has vastly outstepped the bounds laid out for it in the Constitution.
Yeah, and also the fact, too, is that we have complete and very clear-cut violations of the Constitution by this administration. And so, but I've noticed a theme through most of it. We talked a little bit about it last week as well. And you explained a little bit of your, epiphany, your changeover of ideas on this. The concern about having such a convention seems to be a theme that is mentioned a couple of times through both of these pieces here. For our listeners, and could you run through that real quick again? How you perceived it one way and now have changed your opinion?
Well, yes. I had read a book that purported to propose changes to the Constitution called Constitution Cafe by Christopher Phillips. And in the book, several people had proposed pretty inane changes to the Constitution, and I came away from reading that book thinking that this was a stupid idea. We should never open up the Constitution to change, at least to people who don't understand the founders' view of law and government. But since then, and after hearing Michael Ferris's presentation on the topic, I began to do more research, and I came away with the conclusion that it could be done safely if the states follow the plan outlined by the Convention of the States Project, and that is to make application to the Congress, 34 of them, which is the required two-thirds number, 34 states make application to the Congress for a convention for the limited purposes of considering amendments that will restrain the power of the federal government, enact a balanced budget, or term limits. Those three items would be on the agenda. And, of course, the understanding is that those 34 states would instruct their delegates accordingly. Those delegates could only consider amendments that meet that criteria. Now, obviously, 34 states at a convention of 50 states would be an overwhelming majority. And if those states were true to their instructions, the delegates were true to their instructions, and particularly if the delegates were held to civil penalties if they deviated from their instructions, then I think that we could have a convention conducted which would constrain itself to just that topic or those three topics. And Virginia has done such a thing. They've done a state two times have done state conventions which were convened for limited purposes and stayed true to their charters. So I think it can be done. I think we have to trust that there's still the concept of integrity left in the United States, where people who have taken an oath to abide by their instructions will, in fact, do so. And if they do so, the convention could be conducted safely for the limited purposes for which it's been convened.
Okay, let me bring Sam in here. Sam, on the state level, how would it, has such a thing ever been conducted in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, to your knowledge? And, or how would it be done to get this process going if Pennsylvania so wish to do so?
Well, Mark, it hasn't been done. I think last week I did reference that the only time that Pennsylvania's opened up the Constitution that in recent history was 1968, when some changes were done. And it was for a very limited purpose at that point. But as I shared back then, that limited purpose became the opportunity to, in a very subtle way, to actually take and shift primacy from the legislature to the judicial branch. And which has been exercised on more than one occasion, and it was never intended. And that was the point I shared last week. It was not intended. It was a very limited endeavor. And so, as we talked about last week, whereas it is possible to enter into an opening of the Constitution and come out of it accomplishing a very narrow goal in a genuine form, so it remains very open and possible, as it happened here, that it can go into it with a narrow purpose and come out of it with many key issues that fundamentally change the whole thing.
Yeah,
and
that
gives rise, Mark, to the issue that Gary's just talking about, can be done safely. Well, it can be done safely, but there's no assurance, in fact, that it will. But could I raise another question
sure,
at this
sure.
point?
Sure, go ahead.
I think the issue of safety is a primal concern, because most of those who have concerns about opening in a convention fashion is, in fact, the damage that could be done. I think everybody would agree that if you did it and you could really, truly constrain it to the things that very narrowly focused and walk away with it just with that, then in fact, you would walk away with some good changes. But can it be done? I think the overwhelming opposition or question or caution is the risk too great for the opportunity? But I still fundamentally come back to say, why are we doing it? I still ask this question. What is fundamentally flawed with the Constitution that we have? What are we trying to change? And so I want to bring that question up into that, because really that is at heart a lot of what we're talking about. Obviously, we know we have a federal government that's out of control. A lot of it's already been stated. They're too big. They're not following the Constitution as it is right now. There's a whole host of things. You talked about the president this morning himself from the executive branch. The legislature themselves not following the Constitution. They're not even doing it in regard to a number of things. And so we know there's a problem there. The larger question is what we're trying to fix a problem with the Constitution, or is the problem that we're trying to fix a problem with the people who are not doing what they're supposed to do vis-a-vis the Constitution? Because if that's truly the issue, which I tend to believe it is, I don't believe it's the Constitution, then I think we have to talk about a different approach and say, now, how do you fix that problem? So I think with all of this discussion we're going through, we have to keep these things in balance as we walk through to get a conclusion here.
Very, very good point, Sam. In fact, I was thinking that very thing this morning as I was going over my notes for today's program, is the fact of the Constitution as written, fine, amend it to match certain things, but amend it to change it or to enforce it. Yeah, exactly. Chuck, let me get you to weigh in a little bit on this in the legal end.
Bruce, I have a question for Gary, and I think it's a great idea to perhaps maybe bring that convention together to at least discuss these issues. And I think Sam makes a very good point that our Constitution works. It's the people that are working it that aren't doing the job. For example, how many years has it been, Sam, since Harry Reid's passed the budget?
One case in point, very clear. We watch it every time. They're going to try and come back and pass a continuing resolution this next month so that the next Congress doesn't have to, it won't deal with it. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. Here we go.
Exactly. So I think your point is excellent. But my question for Gary, and I'm looking at this from a pure practical standpoint, what are the chances of getting 34 states to even take that initiative, get the people together, and then have nothing more than a media circus in Washington or wherever it's held regarding this and come away with nothing, which in turn, in my opinion, would damage the whole concept of what we're trying to do. And I'm just saying that from a practical standpoint because trying to get a consensus of delegates from 34 states who would really take their charge seriously to look at these issues, I think in this environment, in this political climate we've got, would be very difficult. Gary, what are your thoughts?
Well, it is an extremely high hurdle, and I don't think anyone has a preconceived notion that this is going to be an easy task. It is it's going to be tough. I think they've got their work cut out for them at the Convention of the States Project, and they would readily admit that. But let me address the issue of whether the Constitution, as we know it, is being obeyed or not. And if you go and ask any congressman or senator, they will tell you it is, in fact, being obeyed. And what they are obeying is not the 4,553 words, I think it is, in the original Constitution. They are obeying the Constitution that has been interpreted for them by the hundreds and hundreds of Supreme Court cases that have been handed down since the Constitution was ratified. The U.S. Constitution that is being obeyed today is one found in a document called U.S. Constitution Analysis and Interpretation. It's almost a 3,000-page document that shows how the Supreme Court has interpreted every clause, every word even, in the document. That is the Constitution that is being followed today, and Congress feels like they are obeying that to the letter of the law.
So, Gary, you're saying, in essence, that the Supreme Court and rulings that they have made are now overshadowing the actual Constitution of the United States.
That is precisely the case, and I know I'll be called a heretic for saying this, but there is a flaw in the original Constitution, more than one, actually. The original Constitution, God bless the framers who put it together, it consists of general language that everyone in 1787 thought would be widely understood and would be non-contentious. However, the general language, we'll just take the Interstate Commerce Clause as an example, that the Congress has the power to regulate commerce between the several states. Now, that language, which was pretty broadly stated, has been taken to extremes by the Supreme Court. I think we can all agree to that. So the problem is the general language used in 1787 has been, with license, has been taken to limits that the founders would never have envisioned. And that is the Constitution that is being obeyed today, is the way it has been interpreted by the Supreme Supreme Court.
Gary, why was that even allowed in the first place to be changed and interpreted into a different way?
Because of one man, John Marshall, who in his classic case of Marbury versus Madison stated or established the concept of judicial review, where the Supreme Court has the final say on what the Constitution was intended to mean. And so the Supreme Court now can strike down statutes and state laws and interpret the Constitution the way they perceive it to be. And so they can enact social policy just by interpreting the Constitution to mean what they want it to mean. Roe v. Wade is a perfect example of that.
Now, Sam, that sounds very similar to what you described that happened here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Well, I was going to say, that's effectively exactly what happened,
where
they actually took and now put that, though, into our Constitution so that the primacy rests with the judiciary, which was never the intending of the founders.
Mm-hmm.
And so that does, and I think, Gary, what you're talking about, that is very good history. That's very good instruction. But it brings me to the question of following up, saying, all right, if in practicality, if in practicality, the operative Constitution, let's put it in that perspective, the operative Constitution and constitutional law has in fact become, not just what the founders did, but all of these hosts of case laws and judicial interpretations, which you're talking about, which in fact, you're correct, I think it has been, that's what's hanging out there then. But between what the Supreme Court did there, and what, like, for instance, ours have done here, where the judiciary has actually taken that role and assumed it. The question to me there is, which we were dealing with in Pennsylvania, how do you take that back?
Yeah.
You have a disturbance of the balance of power and the order of power that was originally established. So is not that the issue? And are we talking about opening up the Constitution to reestablish the balance of power? Is that what we're talking about? So anyways, we'll throw it in maybe...
Part of the problem is that justices serve on their good behavior almost for life, because they hardly ever are impeached. So you have a very high hurdle there to remove a justice who interprets the Constitution in non-founders way, I guess we could say. But there are only two ways to reverse a Supreme Court ruling. Either the Supreme Court can reverse itself, which it has done from time to time. There have been horrendous Supreme Court rulings that had to be reversed, Dred Scott being the prime example. And the other way of reversing a Supreme Court ruling is, well, I guess there's two other ways. One is through an amendment. An amendment to the Constitution can reverse a Supreme Court ruling. And then the third mechanism is for Congress to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Now, some people say, well, why doesn't the Congress just limit the jurisdiction so the Supreme Court can no longer rule on abortion? Well, that would leave in place all of the existing case law on the subject of abortion. In other words, you could never reverse Roe v. Wade if the Congress would exercise its Article III powers by limiting the jurisdiction of the court once it has ruled on a certain subject.
Gary, I'm going to cut you off right there. We have to head to a commercial break real quick, but I want to continue where we left off. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People here on Constitution Matters on 1180 AM WFYL. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more.
And we are back from our break here at 1180 AM WFYL, and you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. And today, along with myself, Bruce Stocking, I'm joined by Corinne Lillis, my co-host, and Gary Porter calling us all the way from Hawaii, Sam Rohr, who's in studio, and Chuck Proctor, who's with us as well. And before we went to the break, Gary, you were explaining about your end with the judicial, and I know that Chuck's got some thoughts and things he wants to share on that. So, Gary, I'll let you finish your thought, and then, Chuck, you can come right in.
Well, I was just saying that there are only limited ways to reverse Supreme Court rulings, and the Supreme Court has turned the Founders' Constitution into this wide-open playing field where almost anything goes, and the Congress has taken that wide latitude to grossly overstep their bounds. So I just don't see a lot of good options for restoring the Constitution to its founders' intent. In the debate, the Manassas debate, Bob Marshall came up with eternal vigilance. Yes, the citizens need to have eternal vigilance. And that sounds good. It's a great bumper sticker, but it's not going to get us any very far in restoring an original understanding of the Constitution. And it's really that lack of alternatives to a convention of the states that keeps me coming back to the Convention of the States as the only viable alternative. How else are we going to put this genie back in the box?
Gary, I was mentioning during the break to Bruce and Sam that in the most significant constitutional case of the last year, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in the last paragraph of her dissent in the Hobby Lobby case, and it's in the last paragraph, so it probably is overlooked by most people, she specifically states, without equivocation, that the power of the bench is to legislate as well as to render decisions, that they are superior to the legislative branch. And it is, I was shocked when I read it. I had to read it two or three times to make sure that I was understanding what she was saying. She believes that the Supreme Court and any other court should be legislating from the bench, that they should be taking the lead in this, and that they are the supreme rulers of this type of thing. And what's really scary is we're one heartbeat away from having a major change in the Supreme Court. Right now, with Kennedy as a swing vote, it's not too bad. But if something happens to our four conservative justices and possibly to Kennedy, and you've got Obama still in office to appoint the next Supreme Court justice, we could have a major change on that bench. And Ginsburg retiring doesn't make any difference. You just replace her with another liberal.
Well, Chuck, it's also the fact that's always bothered me, and I've mentioned this many times on this. I might have mentioned it on this program, but I know on It's a New Day I've mentioned this, is with those that are being appointed, the ultimate patronage job, it goes for life, or elected, whatever political party you're affiliated with to get to this point of achieving the job, your political affiliation should actually be washed away and you rule on the merits of a case. I know in a perfect world that's the way you look at it, but we're not looking at that here.
No, that's true. And we were debating this in class the other day. As you know, Bruce, I teach down at Widener University Law School, and the subject came up regarding, well, we have the states where most of your judges are elected. Occasionally they're appointed to fill a vacancy, that mm-hmm. type of thing. But most of them are elected officials, and they run on the Republican or Democratic ticket. That has nothing to do with what they should be deciding on the bench.
Sure.
They should be following the Constitution of the state and of the federal government. At the federal level, everyone is appointed by the president. Now, the president is given a list. He doesn't necessarily know all of the judges personally, but he's given a list. And obviously, political favoritism plays into it. The problem at the federal level is that could be for life.
Yeah.
At the state level, your judges have a 10-year term. Your district magistrates have a 6-year term, which is a long time. But once you're in, once you're an incumbent, it's tough to get thrown out.
You're golden.
Exactly. And you just keep rolling it over because people don't see that as a political issue. You just happen to be on the ticket.
So, thinking of where we're at this point now in the program and what we're discussing here, the main basis being the convention of the states, and, quite obviously brought up and addressed the fact that do we really need to open the Constitution for a change, or as I said during the break as well when we were talking about you got a problem with your foundation crumbling, but you're going to try to address it by fixing the roof, and it doesn't really match on that, is perhaps a convention of the states, and Gary, please weigh in on this when I'm done as well, convention of the states, not so much to change the Constitution, But to have a convention of the states, minus those employees that we have elected to quote-unquote represent us, to sit down and go, how do we make them enforce the law of the land, the Constitution, and to go along those routes? I'll throw that out there.
Gary, before you jump in on that, let me just say one thing. I'm very intrigued by the convention concept, but in listening to Sam this morning, I have to agree with him that maybe we don't want to fix what we already have, but have that convention for the purposes, I think Bruce was just alluding to, hey, what's going on here? What do we need to do to get back to those roots that Sam was talking about, not necessarily add more amendments to the Constitution? And I think that there's a dynamic there that I'd like you to weigh in on.
Well, here, Bruce is quite right. You've got to carefully identify the problem. The problem here is we have a Constitution with broad general language and a court system that has been allowed to legislate from the bench. So if that is the root problem, the fix of that can only be to change the Constitution so as to clarify the language, to make it unambiguous, so that these jurists who want to legislate from the bench do not have the latitude within the language of the Constitution to do so.
Well,
that's,
you know,
what I see the solution.
Go ahead, Gary.
That I see is the only solution. Now, how to safely change the language to clarify and restrict the language so that it cannot be misinterpreted. Remember, let's go back to the preamble to the Bill of Rights. The preamble to the Bill of Rights says, here's why we are making these changes, so as to prevent misconstruction of the Constitution. That was the reason for the Bill of Rights, not to grant rights, but to prevent misconstruction of the language of the Constitution. Well, the Constitution's language has been misconstructed, so we have to clarify that language to remove any opportunity for misconstruction.
Well, you bring up a very good point there, and something that got me thinking, maybe not so much changing the language, but teaching people what language means and the meaning of them. But as I always like to bring up, as far as a terminology with the Constitution that's been misinterpreted, is what's commonly known as the Commerce Clause, that states that the federal government will make regular trade between the states, foreign nations, the Indian nations, and so forth. And the word regulate in there is one that has been so misinterpreted, and the original meaning, as far as I know of it, is to make regular, not to regulate. In other words, saying, Gary, you can't sit on that part of the beach in Hawaii, you got to sit on that part, we're regulating you. So it's to make it regular, though. Gentlemen, your thoughts on that?
Well, I want to jump in and I want to say, going back to education, I know we've brought this up before, if you're never really taught much about the Constitution and how to understand it, then it's going to be so easy to misinterpret it later on, and that's just going to continue on as you get older, and you might not even realize that you're misinterpreting it because you were never really taught how to interpret the Constitution, which I think should be done earlier. The earlier, the better. I mean, you can do it pretty basically, I think.
I think you just nailed it. I really do, because it's not taught in the schools.
Right, and if I have a representative who clearly does not understand the Constitution, I can unelect him in 3 or 6 years, depending on his status. How do I unelect a federal judge who's been appointed for life?
Yeah, well,
Corinne, I was going to jump in there. You made a good point. I have students at the law school, unfortunately, that believe that the concept of separation of church and state is in the Constitution. And I have to take out my copy of the Constitution and read it to them and tell them it's not there.
Use my line, Chuck. I want somebody to show me in any of our documents that actual verbiage.
Right, right. And when I explain it's a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a church, that Baptist church up there in Connecticut or Rhode Island, they're amazed. And it shows the lack of fundamental education in our system on things such as the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, or any of our other important documents. And as Sam, I think, would agree, and Gary would agree, the mindset, the intent is the key word, of our founders, which has been ignored.
Mm-hmm.
I want to remind our listeners really quickly, if they want to call in with any comments, I know we had a listener call in and say some, well, they didn't say, but we talked about the comments that they had about what we were discussing on air. You feel free to. Our number is 610-539-1783. And you can always email us, info@1180wfyl.com.
Now, I'm going to jump in if I can here. I'm going to go back to the whole issue again of why we are talking about what we're talking about, back to the problem. Gary, you have rightly, in my opinion, identified one major problem, and that is the court. We're talking about the courts having effectively placed themselves above the law, making themselves the law, taking upon themselves, as Chuck said about Ginsburg's comment, actually to take the executive branch's role and to enforce the law. So you got a real problem there. But we began this discussion a week ago, and some of those that I've been reading that have been in talking in support of this began by saying the real problem and the real reason for going to a convention is to put things in control and in place to control the out of control spending in Washington, which is a legislative problem. So now we put on the table a legislative excess represented by spending and irresponsive to the American people. So, but we've also identified, as Mark said earlier, a president who goes around it at will on the executive branch. And now we're talking this morning about those in the judicial branch going around it, doing their own thing. So now we've identified excesses in all three branches of government that are all doing their part to violate, or either by sins of commission or omission, the requirements of the Constitution. And so that further substantiates what I think I'm saying is that what in the world is it that we would hope to come out of a Constitution, a change in a convention, that would now make the judicial branch do what they're supposed to do, the legislative branch do what they're supposed to do, and the executive branch do what they're supposed to do, because you really identified problems that exist on all three. Now, that brings me back to the very fundamental concept of what I had shared last week a little bit. This is a little bit of a phrase from William Penn here in Pennsylvania. Said, I know some who... He said this, let us have good laws and no matter for the men that execute them, but let them consider that though good laws do well, good men do better, for good laws may lack good men and may be abolished or evaded, but good men will never lack for good laws nor suffer ill ones. And he goes on and talks about here that the issue is not the law. You can have the best of law. We're talking about the best of law of the Constitution. But if you have individuals that are there to execute and carry them out that are not men of goodwill, of character and integrity, it doesn't make any difference what you put. And that's why I'm saying from the beginning, what is fundamentally flawed about what we have? We don't really have something fundamentally flawed. We have something fundamentally flawed with the way it is interpreted and the way the three branches are all to deal, even among themselves, are not following it. I think that's a different issue, and I think that really is dealt with a different set of approaches than even what we're talking about. So maybe there is something that ought to be done, but I don't think the changing of the Constitution can go at fixing the matter of integrity and character. It can't. It's a framework for how we ought to be abiding ourselves, and this I think leads us into something perhaps different. So I just can't bring myself to say the changes to the Constitution are our end-all, or that it fixes these all three problems. I just don't see how it is, because I don't see a fundamentally flawed position to begin with. I see a flawed interpretation and execution.
Well, Sam, maybe we can look at it this way as well. What I was suggesting, the idea of the Convention of States, basically to get them to follow what the Constitution is and teach them what language means and what words mean as well. But from this, and like I said, to hold such a convention of the states, it would not have our elected employees, as I call them, attending. This would be a delegation of the states that would get along. Very similar, I guess, what Tea Party's doing in a sense. But then it would it not, after comes out of that, fall into First Amendment, then, which is, gives us the right to petition the government for the redress of grievances? Chuck?
Again, I'm a little bit torn on this. Bruce, I see your point, and I see Gary's point on this, of bringing people together to look at it and perhaps find something that we can, I don't want to use the word tweak, but maybe make an adjustment to. And I also see Sam's point that we have a system that if we would just apply it the way it was intended, we wouldn't need to have that convention. But the reason I'm leaning towards the convention a little bit, Sam, is frankly, in the society and political climate that we're in today, I think we need to bring people together and show that there is a consensus to enforce the laws, to enforce the Constitution, to put it together. And I think that may be the greatest thing that we could get out of that convention. And perhaps maybe a tweak or two here and there. But to come in there and say that we've got to change the fundamental formula, that just leads us to possibly, and Gary, you may have some thoughts on this, what in 10 years we'll have another convention, and then another convention, and another convention, and all of a sudden we're going down that, as we say in court, the slippery slope. Where does that lead?
Well, before Gary, you jump in, or Sam, you jump in, and this is a thought I had when you were talking there, Chuck, is this also deals with the people that we hire for these representative jobs of our state, federal, local as well. We need people, as Sam, you say this a lot, with character and morals and values, and those with the ability to lead and with leadership that you're feeling like you're being representative. Certainly we don't have that right now at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I think that right there should really be, because there's a lot of folks that are probably listening to us right now, and they're hearing all this. We've gone 16th Amendment, 17th Amendment. We're talking Convention of States here. I mean, we're going to be steamrolling and rolling along with all kinds of other things as we go through and journey through this document, is that they seem overwhelmed. And the thoughts on, you know, a little bit of a, we can get our country back. We can get our government back. We can get a handle back on the foundation of this house and get it going. And reassurance on that. I'll throw that one out there.
Keep in mind, Bruce, the other thing is, if we have the convention of states and we have representatives there, whatever they take back to their state has to be ratified by the state legislatures.
That's correct.
So you've got a several layers here to work through, and that's what makes it unworkable and may create more division and lack of harmony than we already have. Mm-hmm. That's a threat
sure.
I feel
sure.
Very clearly. So working towards saying to our elected representatives right now, getting people unified to say to them, look, here's what we want you to do. We want you to pass a budget. We want you to control spending. We want you to take care of the security of the nation, not just talk about it. We want you to do something about it. Whatever the issue may be, whatever's on people's minds, have them go there and stop talking about it, stop having caucuses, stop having filibusters. Get some work done.
And Chuck, I'm sorry, Gary. I'm just one quick thing, and then there you go. I'm sorry. One thing that Chuck said, I fully agree with, that if, in fact, the convention were for the purpose of providing a public forum, more or less, a vehicle in which to officially, more visibly, provide for the kind of discussion that we're talking about here that really brings to bear in a system, in a framework that has a lawful constitutional underpinning behind it, again, for the purpose of talking about these things and making it that matter of issue, I say there would be great value to that, because part of what's happening, again, if we say the power is in the people, and it is in this republic, where is the voice for the people? And where do they have a forum? Where can these things be discussed? We're discussing it on the radio right now because many other places don't want to hear it. So we're doing all we can in this setting, but that would be a framework for it. I put out one thing as an example there. in the whole impeachment process within the states or the federal government. We hate that word, but people are scared to death of it because it's become a political tool rather than a cleansing tool. But the purpose was it was to be used regularly and often, as they said. And it wasn't so much that it always ended up in the expelling from office of the person in the judiciary or in the executive branch that were walking contrary to the Constitution, as much as it was an opportunity, a setting to bring to the public light a discussion on the merits of what were in fact matters of omission or commission relative to constitutional oath and duty that would rise to the occasion of a cleansing and a fixing of the system. The failure, I think, to do that often enough have taken that process, which was built in wisely by our founders to help deal with issues of this type, by not dealing with and using what is there. The public neither hears honest debate, nor is there a vehicle put in place by the founders' intent to actually fix the kind of problems we're talking about. It's become almost like an arm that's put in a cast that's become unusable. But it works well if it's worked. And so, in essence, we're talking the same thing. If the convention is there to provide a public opportunity for a discussion to do what should be done, same kind of thing. Impeachment process done the same thing to bring light to infractions of the law and debated not politically but constitutionally. We would have, I think, without changing any law, a vehicle in order to address a lot of what we're talking about.
Gary?
Yes. Okay. Two things. I think it is unlikely, personal feeling, that the Convention of the States will be convened because I think Congress, as the states get close to that 34-state threshold, Congress will propose an amendment to head them off and to take the steam out of their engine. Now, if we had unlimited time to address the fundamental problems of this nation, we would have time to educate the public, get them off their barco loungers and engaged in their government and concerned about the direction of their country. But we do not have time, I don't think, to address this in the proper way. We are facing over $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities, and we are headed for a fiscal waterfall, a cliff that we will, a collapse that we are not going to survive. When the collapse occurs, I think there will be a general call for a new constitution because the old one has obviously failed us, and then instead of the ability to tweak some words and make them unambiguous, we will have, in fact, a call for a brand new constitution. And I fear that more than I fear what might come out of a convention of the states.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, there's a lot of, that can be a minefield to go into. You know, it's one of these, once you walk into the room, you've got to deal with what's in the room. You never know what ramifications have come out of it. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction on here. And it is a very touchy thing to touch this document. And we only have a few minutes left. Just real quick, go around the room. I feel myself that the document itself is whole. The document itself is still good. We just need to understand what the document is and follow the laws laid out. Chuck, I'll start with you.
Bruce, my concern right now is I think that for as far as back as I can remember, we have a preoccupation created by the press with the White House and the people in the White House. The preoccupation there is just astounding. On Fox the other night, Jesse Waters did one of his things where he interviewed people, and he was showing people pictures of famous women. Did you see that?
Yeah.
They could all identify Michelle Obama, but they had no idea who Nancy Pelosi was. A couple of them knew Hillary Clinton. I forget who the other women were that they showed them, but they had no idea. And they didn't understand that Nancy Pelosi was a former Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
They have no idea what's going on in Congress or the Senate. This preoccupation with the White House is totally destructive to what's going on. It used to be we talked about the Speaker. We talked about whoever was in the Senate. And the president, yes, he was part of it, and he got some attention, but not the way it is now. And I think that preoccupation has to change.
Yeah.
and the press has to recognize it as well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, gentlemen, yet again, another hour has gone by rapidly fast here. But I do want to share real quick with our listeners that what we've done today is a discussion and debate over the topic of the Convention of States. The debate and the discussion is not over. This is how it's done, folks. This is how debate should be done by our legislators. An exchange of ideas is what this is. And these exchanges will be continuing as we continue our journey through the Constitution and various issues of the Constitution of the United States. Civil tongue, civil discourse, exchange of ideas, that, if anything, is what this country needs most to understand our precious document. So until next week, I'm Bruce Stocking, joined by Corinne Lillis, Gary Porter, Sam Rohr, Charles Proctor. We'll see you next week on We the People, Constitution Matters. Have a good weekend.